When our conference was over, I showed my visitors out, and I thought I saw, peering from a slightly open doorway at the end of the corridor, the face of Erskine Brown, as horrified and intent as a passerby who suddenly noticed that on the other side of the street the witch's coven is holding its annual beano. The door shut as soon as I noticed him, and Claude vanished within. 20 minutes later, I received a visit from Soapy Sam Ballard, QC, our so-called head of chambers. I don't believe that these events were unconnected. As soon as he got in, Ballard sniffed the air as though detecting the scent of brimstone and said, "You've had them in here, Rumple." "And who in here, Ballard?" "Those who owe allegiance to the evil one." "You mean the Mr. Justice Graves fan club?" "No, no, they haven't been near the place." "Rumple, you know perfectly well who I mean." "Oh, yes, of course," I decided to humour the fellow. "They were all here. Lucifer, Beelzebub, Belial, all present and correct. High on a throne of royal state, which far outshone the wealth of Ormus and of Ind, or where the gorgeous East, with richest hand, showers on her king's barbaric pearl and gold, Satan exalted sat, by merit raised to that bad eminence, and from despair, thus high uplifted beyond hope." "Grow up, Ballard. I am representing an 8-year-old child who's been torn from the bosom of her family and banged up without trial. You see here Rumple, the protector of the innocent." The protector of devil worshippers, Ballard thought. "Those two, if necessary." I sat down at the desk and picked up the papers in a somewhat tedious affray. "Rumple, every decent chambers has to draw the line somewhere." "Does it?" "There are certain cases, certain clients even, which are simply, well, not acceptable."
"Oh, I do agree."
"Do you?"
"Oh, yes, I agree entirely."
"Well, then, I'm glad to hear it."
Soapy Sam looked as gratified as a cleric hearing a deathbed confession from a lifelong heathen. "Didn't I catch sight of you prosecuting an accountant for unpaid VAT? I asked the puzzled QC. "Some cases are simply unacceptable. Far too dull to be touched by a decent barrister with a barge pole. Don't you agree, old darling?"
"Rumple, there's something I meant to raise with you."
The saintly Sam was growing distinctly ratty. "Then buck up and raise it. I'm busy." I returned to the affray.
"Young Charlie Wisbeach wants to come into these chambers. He'd bring us a great deal of high-class commercial work from his father's firm. Unfortunately, we have no room for him at the moment."
"Has he thought of a cardboard box in Middle Temple Lane?"
I thought this was a helpful suggestion. Ballard didn't agree. "This is neither the time nor the place for one of your jokes, Rumple. You have a tenancy here, and tenancies can be brought to an end, especially if the tenant in question is carrying on a practice not in the best traditions of Three Equity Court. There is something in this room which makes me feel uneasy."
"Oh, I do so agree. Perhaps you'll be leaving shortly."
"I'm giving you fair warning, Rumple. I expect you to think it over." At which our leader made for the door, and I called after him,
"Oh, before you go, Ballard, why don't you look up exorcism in the yellow pages? I believe there's an unfrocked bishop in Stepney who'll quote you a very reasonable price. And if you call again, don't forget the holy water." But the man had gone, and I was left alone to wonder exactly what devilment Carrie Timpson had been up to. I have, or at a proper moment I will have, a confession to make. At this time, I was presenting She Who Must Be Obeyed with a mystery which she no doubt found baffling, although I'm afraid a probable solution presented itself to her mind far too soon.
I had reason to telephone a Miss Tatiana Thurn, and not wishing to do so with Hilda's knowledge, and as the lady in question left her house early, I called when I thought she was still asleep. I now suspect Hilda was listening in on the bedroom extension. Although she lay motionless, and with her eyes closed when I came back to bed. Later, I discovered that when Hilda went off to shop in Harrods, she spotted me coming out of Knightsbridge Tube Station, a place far removed from the Temple and the Old Bailey, and sleuthed me to a house in Mowbray Crescent, which she saw me enter when the front door was opened by the aforesaid Tatiana Thurn. So it came about that she met Marigold, Mr. Justice Featherstone's outspoken wife, and together they formed the opinion that Rumpel was up to no good whatsoever. Of course, she didn't tackle me openly about this, but I could sense what was in the wind when she started up a conversation about the male libido at breakfast one morning. It followed from something she had read in her Daily Telegraph. "They're doing it again, Rumpel." "Who are?"
"Men."
"Ah. Causing trouble in the workplace?"
"Yes, I suppose so."
"Brushing up against their secretaries?"
"Unnecessarily."
"I suppose that's something you approve of, Rumpel?"
"I haven't got a secretary, Hilda. I've got a clerk called Henry. I've never felt the slightest temptation to brush up against Henry."
And that answer, you might have thought, would finish the matter. But Hilda had more information from the Telegraph to impart. "They put it all down to glands. Men have got too much something in their glands." "That's a fine excuse, isn't it?"
"Never tried it, but I thought it over."
"I suppose I might. My client intends to rely on the glandular defence, my lord."
"It wouldn't wash,"
Hilda was positive. "When I was a child, we were taught to believe in the devil."
"I'm sure you were."
"He tempts people, particularly men."
"I thought it was Eve."
"What?"
"I thought it was Eve he tempted first."
"That's you all over, Rumpel."
"Is it?"
"Blame it all on a woman. That's men all over."
"Hilda, there's nothing I'd like more than to sit here with you all day discussing theology, but I've got to get to work."
I was making my preparation for departure when she said darkly,
"Enjoy your lunch, huh?"
"What did you say?"
"I said, I hope you enjoy your lunch, Rumpel."
"Well, I probably shall. It's Thursday. Steak pie at the pub in Ludgate Circus. I shall look forward to that."
"And a few other little treats besides, I should imagine."
Hilda was immersed in her newspaper again when I left her. I knew then that no matter what explanation I had given, she who must be obeyed had come to the firm conclusion that I was up to something devilish. It's a strange fact that it was not until nearly the end of the 80 years allotted to me by the psalmist that I was first called upon to perform in a juvenile court. It was, as I was soon to discover, a place in which the law, as we know and occasionally love it, had very little place. It was also a soulless chamber in Crockthorpe's already chipped and crumbling glass and concrete courthouse complex. Tracy's three judges, a large, motherly-looking magistrate as chairwoman, flanked by a small, bright-eyed Sikh justice in sari and a lean and anxious headmaster, sat with their clerk, young, officious and bespectacled, to keep them in order. The defence team, Rumpel and the indispensable Bernard, together with the prosecutor, Ms. Liz Probert, and a person from the counsel solicitor's office, sat at another long table opposite the justices. Miss Mirabel Jones, armed with a ponderous file, was comfortably ensconced in the witness chair, and a large television set was playing that hit video, The Interview with Dominic Molloy. We have got to the familiar dialogue which started with Mirabel's question. He wanted you to play at devils. This man did.
He said he was the devil, yes, the picture of the boy Dominic alleged.
He was the devil, and what were you supposed to be? I suppose you were the devil's children.
At which point, Rumpel ruined the entertainment by rearing to his hind legs and making an objection, a process which, in this court, seemed as unusual and unwelcome as a guest lifting his soup plate to his mouth and slurping the contents at a state banquet at Buckingham Palace. When I said I was objecting, the clerk switched off the telly with obvious reluctance. That was a leading question by the social worker, I said, although the fact would have been obvious to the most superficial reader of potted rules of evidence. It and the answer are entirely inadmissible, as your clerk will no doubt tell you. And I added, in an extremely audible whisper to Bernard, if he knows his business.
Mr. Rumpel, the chairwoman gave me her most motherly smile, Miss Mirabel Jones is an extremely experienced social worker. We think we can rely on her to put her question in the proper manner. I was just venturing to point out that on this occasion she put her question in an entirely improper manner, I told her. Madam.
The bench will see the film out to the end, Mr. Rumpel. You'll have a chance to make any points later.
The clerk gave his decision in a manner which caused me to whisper to Mr. Bernard, her master's voice.
I hope they all heard, but to make myself clear, I said to Madam Chair, my point is that you shouldn't be seeing this film at all.
We are going to continue with it now, Mr. Rumpel.
The learned clerk switched on the video again.
Miss Jones appeared to ask, what was the game you had to play?
And Dominic answered,
dance around.
Dance around, Mirabel Jones's shadow repeated, in case we had missed the point.
Now, tell me, Dominic, at Tracy Timpson's house, is that where you met the man?
It's a leading question, I said aloud, but the performance continued, and Mirabel asked,
do you know who he was?
And on the screen, Dominic nodded politely.
Who was he?
Mirabel asked, and Dominic replied, Tracy's dad.
As the video was switched off, I was on my feet again.
You're not going to allow that evidence.
I couldn't believe it.
Pure hearsay. What a child who isn't called as a witness said to Miss Jones here, a child we've had no opportunity of cross-examining said, is nothing but hearsay, absolutely worthless.
Madam Chairwoman,
Miss Probert rose politely beside me.
Yes, Miss Probert?
Liz got an even more motherly smile. She was the favourite child, and Rumpel, the black sheep of the family.
Mr. Rumpel is used to practising at the Old Bailey,
and had managed to organise a nodding acquaintance with the law of evidence, I added.
And, of course, this court is not bound by strict rules of evidence. Where the welfare of a child is concerned, you're not tied down by a lot of legal quibbles about hearsay.
Quibbles?
Miss Probert, did I hear you say quibbles?
My righteous indignation was only half simulated.
You are free, Liz told the tribunal, with the able assistance of Miss Mirabel Jones to get at the truth of this matter.
My learned friend was my pupil.
I was, I must confess, more than a little hurt. I spent months, a year of my life, in bringing her up with some rudimentary knowledge of the law. And when she says that the rule against hearsay is a legal quibble...
Mr. Rumpel, I don't think my bench wants to waste time on a legal argument. The clerk of the court breathed heavily on his glasses and polished them briskly.
Do they not? Indeed. I was launched on an impassioned protest, and no one was going to stop me.
So does it come to this? Down at the Old Bailey, that backward and primitive place, no villain can be sent down to Chokey as a result of a leading question or a bit of gossip in the saloon bar, or what a child said to a social worker and wasn't even cross-examined.
But little Tracy Timpson, 8 years old, can be banged up for an indefinite period, snatched from the family that loves her, without the protection the law affords to the most violent bank robber. Is that the proposition that Miss Liz Probert is putting before the court? And which apparently finds favour in the so-called legal mind of the court official, who keeps jumping up like a jack-in-the-box to tell you what to do? Even as I spoke, the clerk, having shined up his spectacles to his total satisfaction, was whispering to his well-upholstered chair. Mr. Rumpole, my bench would like to get on with the evidence. Speeches will come later. The chairwoman handed down her clerk's decision. They will, madam. They most certainly will, I promised. And then as I sat down, profoundly discontented, Liz presumed to teach me my business. Let me give you a tip, Rumpole, she whispered. I should keep off the law if I were you. They don't like it around here, huh? While I was recovering from this lesson given to me by my ex-pupil, our chairwoman was addressing Mirabel as though she were a mixture of Mother Teresa and Princess Anne. Miss Jones, she purred, we are grateful for the thoroughness with which you've gone into this difficult case on behalf of the local authority. Oh, thank you so much, Madam Chair. And we've seen the interview you carried out with Tracy on the video film. Was there anything about that interview which you thought especially significant? It was when I showed her the picture of the devil, Mirabel answered. She wasn't frightened at all. In fact, she laughed. I thought, is there any point in my telling you that what this witness thought isn't evidence? I sent up a cry of protest. Carry on, Miss Jones, if you'd be so kind. Madam Chair decided to ignore the Rumpole interruption. I thought it was because it reminded her of someone she knew pretty well. Someone like Dad. Mirabel now put in the boot with considerable delicacy. Someone like Dad. Yet, likely to trace his hope of liberty. Have you any questions, Mr. Rumpole? So I rose to cross-examine. It's no easy task to attack a personable young woman from one of the caring professions, but this Miss Mirabel Jones was, as far as my case was concerned, a killer. I decided that there was only one way to approach her, and that was to go in with all guns firing. Miss Jones, I loosed the first salvo, you are, I take it, against cruelty to children? Of course. That goes without saying. Does it? Can you think of a more cruel act to a little child than coming at dawn with the old bill and snatching it away from its mother and father without even a Barbara doll for consolation? Barbie doll, Mr. Rumpole, Roz whispered urgently. What? It's a Barbie doll, Mrs. Timpson says. Mr. Bernard instructed me on what didn't seem to be the most vital point in the case. Oh, very well, Barbie doll. And I returned to the attack on Mirabel. Without that, or a single toy, we don't want the children to be distracted by thoughts of home. Well, yes. You wanted Tracy to concentrate on your dotty idea of devil worship, I put it bluntly. It wasn't a dotty idea, Mr. Rumpole, and I had to act quickly. Tracy had to be removed from the presence of evil. Evil? What do you mean by that, exactly? The witness hesitated, momentarily at a loss for a suitable definition in a rational age, and Miss Liz Probert rose to the rescue. You ought to know, Mr. Rumpole. Haven't you had plenty of experience of that down at the Old Bailey? Oh, well played, Miss Probert, I congratulated her loudly. Your pupilling days are over. Now, Miss Mirabel Jones, I returned to my real opponent. Let's come down, if we may, from the world of legend and hearsay and gossip and fantasy to what we call down at the Old Bailey hard facts. You know that my client, Mr. Carrie Timpson, is a small-time thief and a minor villain. I have given the bench the list of Dad's criminal convictions, yes. Mirabel looked obligingly into her file. It's not the sort of record, is it, Mr. Rumpole, that you might expect a good father to have? The chair smiled as she invited me to agree, but I declined to do so. Oh, I don't know, I said. Are only the most law-abiding citizens meant to have children? Are we about to remove their offspring from share-pushers, inside dealers and politicians who don't tell the truth? If we did, even this tireless local authority would run out of children's homes to bang them up in. Speeches come later, Mr. Rumpole. The loquacious clerk could keep silent no longer. They will, I promised him. Carrie Timpson is a humble member of the Clan Timpson, that vast family of South London villains. Now, remind us of the name of that imaginative little boy you interviewed on primetime television.
Dominic Molloy, Mirabel knew by heart.
Molloy, yes. And as we've been told so often, you are an extremely experienced social worker.
I think so.
With a vast knowledge of the social life in this part of South London.
I get to know a good deal, yes, yes, of course, I do.
Of course. So it will come as no surprise to you if I suggest that the Molloys are a large family of villains of a slightly more dangerous nature than the Timpsons.
I didn't know that, but if you say so...
Oh, I do say so. Did you meet Dominic's mother, Mrs. Peggy Molloy?
Oh, yes. I had a good old chat with Mum over a cuppa.
The bench and Mirabel exchanged smiles. And over a cuppa, did she tell you that her husband Gareth, Dominic's dad, was in Wandsworth as a result of the Tobler Road supermarket affair?
Mr. Rumpole, my bench is wondering if this is entirely relevant.
The clerk had been whispering to the chair and handed the words down from on high. Then let your bench keep quiet and listen, I told him. It'll soon find out. So, what's the answer, Miss Jones? Did you know that?
I didn't know that Dominic's dad was in prison.
Miss Jones adopted something of a light, insouciant tone. And that he suspected Tracy's dad, as you would call him, Carrie Timpson, of having been the police informer who put him there?
Did he?
The witness seemed to find all this talk of adult crime somewhat tedious. Oh, yes. And I should be calling hearsay evidence to prove it. Miss Jones, are you telling this bench that you, an experienced social worker, didn't bother to find out about the deep hatred that exists between the Molloys and the Timpsons?
Stretching back over generations of villainy to the dark days when Crockthorpe was a village and the local villains swung outside Newgate Prison?
I have nothing about that in my file, Mirabel told us, as though that made all such evidence completely unimportant. Nothing in your file. And your file hasn't considered the possibility that young Dominic Molloy might have been encouraged to put an innocent little girl of a rival family in the frame, as we're inclined to call it, down the Old Bailey.
Seemed rather far-fetched to me.
Mirabel gave me her most superior smile. Far-fetched, Miss Jones? To you, who believe in devil worship?
I believe in evil influences on children.
Mirabel chose her words carefully.
Yes.
Then let us just examine that. Your superstitions were first excited by the fact that a number of children appeared in the playground of Cropthorpe Junior wearing masks.
Devil's masks,
yes. Yet the only one you took into so-called care was Tracy Timpson.
She was the ringleader. I discovered that Tracy had brought the masks to school in that kit bag with her lunch and her reading books.
Did you ask her where she got them from?
I did. Of course, she wouldn't tell me.
Mirabel smiled, and I knew a possible reason for Tracy's silence.
Even if Carrie had been indulging in satanic rituals, his daughter would never have grasped on him.
I assumed it was from her father.
Mirabel inserted her elegant boot once more. Miss Mirabel Jones, let's hope that at some point we'll get to a little reliable evidence and that this case doesn't rely entirely on your assumptions. The lunch break came none too soon, and Mr. Bernard and I went in search of a convenient watering hole. The jolly grocer was to Pomeroy's wine bar what the Crockthorpe Court was to the Old Bailey. It was a large, bleak pub, and the lounge bar was resonant with the bleeping of computer games and the sound of muzak. Pomeroy's claret may be at the bottom of the market, but I suspected that the jolly grocer's red would be pure paint stripper. I refreshed myself on a couple of bottles of Guinness and a pork pie, which was only a little better than minced rubber encased in cardboard, and then we started the short walk back to the Crockthorpe Palais de Justice. On the way, I let Bernard know my view of the proceedings so far. It's all very well to accuse the deeply caring Miss Mirabel Jones of guessing, I told him, but we've got to tell the old darlings on the bench, Bonnie Bernard, where the hell the masks came from. Our client, Mr. Carrie Timpson. You mean Dad? Yes. He denies all knowledge. Does he? And then, quite suddenly, I came to a halt. I found myself outside a shop called Wedges Carnival and Novelty Stores. The window was full of games, fancy dress, hats, crackers, Halloween costumes, Father Christmas costumes, masks, and other equipment for parties and general merrymaking. It was while I was gazing with a wild surmise at these goods on display that I said to Bernard, in a somewhat awestruck tone, or of a watcher of the skies when a new planet swims into his ken, "Well, he would, wouldn't he? The honour of the Timpsons." "What do you mean, Mr. Rumpel? What's the name of this street? Is it by any chance..." It was. My instructing solicitor, looking up at a street sign, said, "Gunston Avenue. Who robbed Wedges?" We had arrived back at the courthouse with 10 minutes in hand, and I found Carrie Timpson smoking a last fag on the gravel outside the main entrance. His wife was with him, and I lost no time in asking the vital question. "Mr. Rumpel," Tracy's dad looked round and lowered his voice, "you know I can't." "Grass? It's the code of the Timpsons, isn't it? Well, let me tell you, Carrie, there's something even more important than your precious code." "I don't know it, then." "Oh, yes, you do. You know it perfectly well. Get that wallet out, why don't you? Look at the photographs you were so pleased to show me. Look at them, Carrie." Carrie took out his wallet and looked obediently at the pictures of the much-loved Tracy. "Is she less important than honour among thieves?" I asked them both. Ros looked at her husband, her jaw set and her eyes full of determination. I knew then what the answer to my question would have to be. The afternoon's proceedings dragged on without any new drama, and although Carrie had told me what I needed to know, I hadn't yet got his leave to use the information. The extended Timpson family would have to be consulted. When the day's work was done, I took the tube back to the temple, and with my alcohol content having sunk to a dangerous low, I went at once to Pomeroy's for first aid. Then I was unfortunate enough to meet my proposed cuckoo, the old Etonian Charlie Wisbeach, who, being not entirely responsible for his actions, was administering champagne to a toothy and slony girl solicitor called, if I can bring myself to remember the occasion when she instructed me in a robbery and forgot to summon the vital witness, Miss Arabella Mundy. Wisbeach greeted me with a raucous cry of, "Rumpel, old man, glass of bolly." "Why? What are you celebrating?" I did my best to sound icy. All the same, I possessed myself of a glass, which he filled unsteadily. "Ballard asked me in for a chat. It seems there may be a vacancy in your chambers, Rumpel." "Wherever Ballard is, there's always a vacancy." "What do you mean, exactly?"
Pity you blotted your copybook.
My what?
Not very clever of you, was it, defending devil worshippers with such a remarkably devout head of chambers? It seems I may soon be occupying your room, old man, looking down on the Temple Church and Oliver Goldsmith's tomb.
I looked at the slightly swaying Miss Beach for a long time, and then, as I sized up my enemy, a kind of plot began to form itself in my mind.
Dr. Johnson's, I corrected the man again. You told me it was Oliver Goldsmith's.
No, I told you it was Dr. Johnson's.
Goldsmith's?
Johnson's.
You want to bet?
Charlie Wisbeach's face moved uncomfortably close to mine.
Does old Roly-Poly-Rumpole want to put his money where his mouth is, does he?
£10. Says it's Johnson.
I'm going to give you odds.
Charlie was clearly an experienced gambler.
3-1 against Johnson. Ollie Goldsmith evens. 20-1 the field. Since I'm taking over the room, we'll check on it tomorrow.
Why not now? I challenged him.
What?
Why not check on it now? I repeated. £30 in my pocket and I can take a taxi home.
£10 down and you walk. All right then. Come on, Arabella. Bring the bottle, little girl.
As they left Pomeroy's, I hung behind, and then went to the telephone on the wall by the gents. I'd seen the light in Bellard's window when I came up from Temple Station. He usually worked late, partly because he was a slow study, so far as even the simplest brief was concerned, and partly, I believe, because of a natural reluctance to go home to his wife, Marguerite, a trained nurse, who had once been the Old Bailey's merciless matron. I put in a quick telephone call to Soapy Sam and advised him to look out of his window in about 5 minutes' time and pay particular attention to any goings-on in the Temple Churchyard. Then I went to view the proceedings from a safe distance. What I saw, and what Sam Bellard saw from his grandstand view, was Charlie Wisbeach holding a bottle and a blonde. He gave a triumphant cry of, "Oliver Goldsmith!" and then mounted the tomb as though it were a hunter, and alternately swinging from the bottle and kissing Miss Arabella Mundy, he laughed loudly at his triumph over Rumpole. It was a satanic sound, so far as our head of chambers was concerned, and this appalling graveyard ritual convinced him that Charlie Wisbeach, who no doubt spent his spare moments reciting the Lord's Prayer backwards, was a quite unsuitable candidate for a place in a Christian chambers such as Three Equity Court. That night, certain important events were taking place in my client's home in Morrison Close, Crockthorpe. Numerous Timpsons were assembled in the front room, assisted by minor villains and their wives. Carrie's Uncle Fred, the undisputed head of the family, was there, as was Uncle Dennis, who should long ago have retired from a life of crime to his holiday home on the Costa del Sol. I've done my best to reconstruct the debate from the account given to me by Roz. After a general family discussion and exchange of news, Uncle Fred gave his opinion of the Wedgie's job.
"Bloody joke shop. I always said it was a bad idea, robbing a joke shop.
There was always money left in the till overnight. Our info told us that. And the security was hopeless. Through the back door, like."
Uncle Dennis explained the thinking behind the enterprise.
"What you want to leave the stuff round my place for?"
Carrie was naturally aggrieved because the booty had, it transpired, included a box of satanic masks, to which, as they were left in her father's garage, young Tracy had easy access.
"You should have known how dangerous them things were, what with young kids and social workers about."
"Well, Fred's was under constant surveillance," Uncle Dennis explained, "as was mine, and seeing as you and Roz was away on Monday..."
"Oh, thank you very much," Carrie was sarcastic.
"And then knowing where you kept your garage key..." Uncle Fred was doing his best to protect Uncle Dennis from charges of carelessness.
"Lucky that Bill never thought of looking there," Carrie pointed out. "I meant to come back for the stuff sometime. It was a bit of a trivial matter. It slipped my memory, quite honestly." Uncle Dennis was notoriously forgetful, once having left his fisherman's diary containing his name and address at the scene of a crime.
Well, it wasn't no trivial matter for our Tracy.
No, I knows, Roz. Sorry about that.
Look, Den,
Carrie started, I'm not asking you to put your hands up to Chief Inspector Brush.
Yes, we are, Carrie. Roz was in deadly earnest. That's just what we're asking. You've got to do it for our Tracy.
Hang about a bit. Uncle Dennis looked alarmed. Who says we got to? And then Roz told him.
Mr. Rumpel.
So the next morning, Dennis Timpson gave evidence in the juvenile court. Although I had been careful to explain his criminal record, he looked, in his comfortable tweed jacket and cavalry twill trousers, the sort of chap that might star on Gardner's Question Time, and I could see that Madam Chair took quite a shine to him. After some preliminaries, we got to the heart of the matter.
I was after the money, really, Dennis told the bench. But I suppose I got a bit greedy-like. I just shoved a few of those boxes in the back of the vehicle, and then I didn't want to take them round to my place, so I left them in Carrie's garage.
Why did you do that?
I asked. Well, young Carrie didn't have anything to do with the Wedges job, so I thought they'd be safe enough there. Of course, I was under considerable work at that time, and it slipped my mind to tell Carrie and Roz about it.
Did you see what was in any of those cases?
I had a little look in. Seemed like a lot of carnival masts, and that sort of rubbish.
So young Tracy getting hold of the devil's masks was just the usual Timpson cock-up, was it?
What did you say, Mr. Rumpel?
The chairwoman wasn't quite sure she could believe her ears. It was a stock-up for Christmas, Madam Chair, I explained.
One more thing, Mr. Dennis Timpson. Do you know why young Dominic Molloy has accused Tracy and her father of fiendish rituals in the churchyard?
Course I do, Uncle Dan had no doubt. Peggy Molloy told Barry Peacock's wife, and Barry's wife told my Doreen down the Needle Arms last Thursday.
We can't possibly have this evidence,
Liz Probert rose to object. Perhaps she'd caught the habit from me.
Oh, really, Miss Probert? I looked at her in amazement. And why ever not?
What Barry's wife told Mrs. Timpson is pure hearsay.
Miss Probert was certain of it.
Of course it is, and I gave her back her argument. And pure hearsay is totally acceptable in this juvenile court. Where the interest of the child is at stake, we are not bound by legal quibbles.
I agree, Madam Chair, with every word which has fallen from your respected and highly learned clerk.
Now then, Mr. Timpson, what did you hear exactly?
Gary thought Carrie had grassed on him over the Tobler Road market job, so they got young Dominic to put the frame round Tracy and her dad.
So what you are telling us, Mr. Timpson, is that this little boy's evidence was pure invention. At last, Madam Chair seemed to have got the message. Uncle Dennis gave her the most charming and friendliest of smiles, as he said,
"Well, you can't trust the Molloys, can you, my lady? Everyone knows they're a right family of villains."
There comes a time in many cases when the wind changes, the tide turns, and you're either blown onto the rocks or make safe harbour. Uncle Dennis's evidence changed the weather, and after it, I noticed that Madam Chair no longer returned Miss Mirabel Jones's increasingly anxious smile. Miss Probert's final address was listened to in stony silence, and I was startled to hear a distinct thank you from the bench as I sat down. After a short period of retirement, the powers that were to shape young Tracy Timpson's future announced that they were dissatisfied by the evidence of any satanic rituals, and that she was accordingly to be released from custody forthwith. Before this judgment was over, the tears which Roz had fought to control since the dawn raid were released, and at her moment of joy she cried helplessly. I couldn't resist it. I got into Mr. Burnett's car and followed the Timpson Cortina to the children's home. We waited until we saw the mother and father emerge from that gaunt building, each holding one of their daughter's hands. As they came down the steps to the street, they swung her in the air between them, and when they got into the car, they were laughing. Miss Mirabel Jones, who had brought the order for release, stood in the doorway of the Lilacs and watched without expression. And then Tracy's legal team drove away to do other cases with less gratifying results. When I got home, after a conference in an obtaining credit by fraud and a modest celebration at Pomeroy's wine bar, Hilda was not in the best of moods. When I told her that I brought glad tidings, all she said was, "You seem full of yourself, Rumpo. Been having a good time, have you?" "A great time. Managed to extricate young Tracy Timpson from the clutches of the Caring Society, and she's back in the bosom of her family. And I'll be getting another brief, defending Dennis Timpson on a charge of stealing from Wedge's Carnival Novelties. Well, I expect I'll think of something." I poured myself a glass of wine to lighten the atmosphere, and Hilda said, somewhat darkly, "You never wanted to be a judge, did you, Rumpel? Judging people? Condemning them? No, it's not my line, exactly. Anyway, judges are meant to keep quiet in court. And they're much more restricted, aren't they? It may have sounded an innocent question on a matter of general interest, but her voice was full of menace. "Restricted," I repeated, "playing for time. Stuck in court all day, in the public eye and on their best behavior. They have far less scope than you to indulge in other activities." "Activities, Hilda?" "Oh, yes. Perhaps it's about time we really talked for once, Rumpel. Is there something that you feel you ought to tell me?" "Well, yes, Hilda, yes. As a matter of fact, there is." I had, in fact, done something which I found it strangely embarrassing to mention. "I suppose you've had time to think up some ridiculous defense?" "Oh, no, I plead guilty. There are no mitigating circumstances." "Rumpel, how could you?" The court was clearly not going to be moved by any plea for clemency. "Temporary insanity, but I did it at enormous expense." "You had to pay?" It would scarcely be an exaggeration to say that Hilda snorted. "Well, they don't give these things away for nothing."
"I imagine not."
100 smackers. But it is your birthday next week."
"Rumpel, I can't think what my birthday has got to do with it."
At least I had managed to puzzle her a little. "Everything, Hilda. I've just bought us 2 tickets for the Scales of Justice Ball. Now, what was it you wanted us to talk about?"
All I can say is that Hilda looked extremely confused. It was as though Mr. Injustice Graves was just about to pass a stiff sentence of chokey and had received a message that, as it was the Queen's birthday, there would be a general amnesty for all prisoners. "Well," she said, "not at the moment. Perhaps some other time."
And she rescued the lamb chops from the oven with the air of a woman suddenly and unexpectedly deprived of a well-justified and satisfactory outburst of rage. Matters were not altogether resolved when we found ourselves at a table by the dance floor in the Savoy Hotel in the company of Sam Ballard and his wife Marguerite, who always, even in a ball gown, seemed to carry with her a slight odour of antiseptic and soap. Also present were Marigold Featherstone, wife of a judge whose foot was never far from his mouth, Claude Erskine Brown and Liz Probert with her partner, co-mortgagee and fellow member of Three Equity Court, young Dave Inchcape. "Too bad Guthrie's sitting at Newcastle," Claude commiserated with Marigold Featherstone on the absence of her husband and told her, "Phillies in Swansea, prosecuting the Leisure Centre murder." "Never mind, Claude," and Marguerite Ballard added menacingly, "I'll dance with you, Oh, yes, Erskine Brown. Her husband was smiling. You have my full permission to shake a foot with my wife. Oh, well, yes. Thank you very much. I say, I thought Charlie Wisbeach and his girlfriend were going to join us. Claude seemed unreasonably disappointed. No, Erskine Brown. The Ballard lips were even more pursed than usual. Young Wisbeach won't be joining us, not at the ball, and certainly not in chambers.
Oh, really? I thought it was more or less fixed.
I think, Claude, it's become more or less unstuck. I disillusioned him. In the ensuing chatter, I could hear Marigold Featherstone indulging in some whispered dialogue with my wife, which went something like this.
Have you faced him with it yet, Hilda?
I was just going to do it when he told me we were coming here. He behaved well, for once.
They do that occasionally. Don't let it put you off.
Further whispers were drowned as Erskine Brown said to Ballard in a loud and challenging tone, May I ask you why Charlie Wisbeach isn't joining us after all? Not on this otherwise happy occasion, Erskine Brown. I can only say practices.
Well, of course he practices in the commercial court.
And Claude turned to me, full of suspicion.
Do you know anything about this, Rumpole?
Me? Know anything? Nothing whatever. I certainly wasn't prepared to incriminate myself.
I've told Wisbeach we simply have no accommodation. I do not regard him as a suitable candidate to share Rumpole's room. It will be far better for everyone if we never refer to the matter again.
So our head of chambers disposed of the case of Rumpole versus Wisbeach, and the band played an old number from the days of my youth called Smoke Gets in Your Eyes.
Now, as head of chambers, Ballard claimed his alleged rights, I think I should lead my wife out onto the floor.
No, no, Ballard, with all due respect, I rose to my feet. As the longest-serving chamber's wife, she, that is Mrs. Rumpole, should be led out first.
Care for a dance, Hilda?
Rumpole, are you sure you can manage it?
Hilda was astonished.
Perfectly confident, thank you.
And without a moment's hesitation, I applied one hand to her waist, seized her hand with the other, and steered her fearlessly out onto the parquet. Where, though I say it myself, I propelled my partner for life in strict time to the music. I even indulged in a little fancy footwork as we cornered in front of a table full of solicitors.
You're chassis-ing, Rumpole.
She was astonished. Oh, yes, I do that quite a lot nowadays.
Wherever did you learn?
To be quite honest with you, if you're capable of such a thing... She had not been altogether won over. From a Miss Tatiana Fern. I looked her up in the yellow pages. One time Southern Counties ballroom champion. I took a few lessons.
Where did you take lessons?
Place called Mowbray Crescent.
Somewhere off Sloane Street?
Hilda, you knew.
Oh, don't ever think you can do anything I don't know about.
At which point the Ballards passed us, not dancing in perfect harmony.
You're really quite on your feet, Rumpole.
Margaret Ballard's looking absolutely green with envy. And then after a long period of severity, she actually smiled at me.
You are an old devil, Rumpole, she said.